International Rugby on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Irish Dairy. Its natural goodness makes it a real winner. Win with dairy.ie.
And hello from Damien O'Mara. You are very welcome to the Rugby Show, RTE Sports Rugby Podcast. We are here for the last programme dedicated to Rugby World Cup 2015. No real surprise for a lot of people, New Zealand crown champions. Wes and I will be joined in just a minute by Donal Lenehan, who was alongside Michael Corcoran for commentary of the game on Radio 1 on Saturday afternoon. We will reflect upon the final, we will reflect upon the tournament, and we will also chat a little bit about what lessons Ireland's bid for 2023 can take from 2015.
Top referee in the world in charge of the match this afternoon. Carter comes up now with the utmost of attention, kicks it between the posts, it's New Zealand into the lead. And Bernard Foley now with the penalty attempt for Australia to try and tie this game up, nudges this one and kicks it, it's gone between the posts and the sides are absolutely tied up here, almost 14 minutes gone, 3 points apiece. Carter takes 5 paces forward, keeps the head down, slots this one, hits it, and he's nudged it straight between the posts. That's sort of lazy but massively effective style, and he takes a high five there from Brodie Retallick. It's New Zealand back into the lead by 6 points to 3. And Carter now looking to extend the lead of New Zealand as he comes up now and launches this one, he kicks it, and it's gone straight between the posts. So it is New Zealand by that 6 points, 9 points to 3. Available here, swept back, and they look to have Richie McCall, who's it off, Miller fell up on the corner, and gets in for the try on the near side of the pitch in the final minute of the first half of this game. We got the opening try. Sonny Bill again gets his hands free, now towards Manano, over the 10-meter line, Manano towards the 20-down, Manano gets it, 20-down, goes for the line, Manano for the try. Australia now trying to drive New Zealand back, they have control of it, 5 yards. Short of the line is Australia, try for the line, Australia into the try on the near side of the pitch, and it's David Pocock who's got the try. Available for Will Guinea, 17 in from the touchline, gets the kick away, goes chasing back after that one, there's a chance here because the ball is bouncing up and Australia have it inside the 22, and they go for the line, under the post, and goal, and score a try, it's Davina Corradani. With 7 points between the teams. Dan Carter for New Zealand as he comes up, pumps this one, it's going towards the post. Dan Carter's kick has gone straight between the posts. There's more than a score between the teams. And Smith now on the counter-attack, Gareth that one, Bowden Barrett goes chasing after that, Bowden Barrett towards the 22, it hops up for Barrett, he looks to get it out. His Royal Highness presents the trophy to Richie McCall, standing in the middle of the pitch at Twickenham Stadium, and Richie McCall nips the Webb Ellis trophy, and New Zealand are acclaimed as champions of the world for 2015. What a tournament, what a champion team, what a sensational performance by New Zealand this afternoon.
And you're very welcome to the programme. Wes, how are you?
Very well, thanks, Damien.
Let's get straight down to business. Donal Lenehan, how are you doing?
I'm great, Damien. Small bit of a hangover from the World Cup, but look, I suppose it had to come to an end at some stage.
You've only got 4 years to wait now for Japan, so we'll wait and see how it all plays out. Come here, we'll talk a little bit, we'll get your overall reflections in a couple of minutes, but I suppose the dust still settling on the final, the All Blacks sweeping the awards last night at the World Rugby Awards. How good a final did New Zealand and Australia dish up, in your opinion?
Oh, I thought it was an outstanding final. I mean, there's always... Finals in any sport rarely live up to the expectation. Everybody was saying coming into the decider last Saturday, the two best teams in the World Cup, the best referee in the World Cup, And in my view, it did stand up to the pre-match scrutiny. I thought it was a fascinating game. New Zealand are just such a powerful unit. The way they started the game was the exact same way as they started against South Africa the previous week. They just dominate territory and possession. They put you under so much pressure that it has to take a toll as the game is going on. And I think that's exactly what happened. But, you know, in true Australian spirit, they never give up. And the way they came back and closed the game to within 4 points shows just how good a side Australia are. I mean, I think the problem with this New Zealand side, they make very good teams look ordinary at times, and that is a very good Australian side. Now, I think the injuries took their toll. Kane Douglas going off early certainly affected their line-out. Matt Gitto was a huge loss to them. But for me, the key moments when they came back within 4 points, Carter just grabbed hold of the game. And, you know, within 7 or 8 minutes, they'd won the final a second time.
Yeah. Obviously, Donald, massively fitting, and no real rugby fan would begrudge McCaw and Carter and these guys going out on that high and really cemented their legacy. I suppose, you know, there's been a certain kind of element of the media, certainly in this part of the world, often revelling in the rare New Zealand defeats. But really, this team, kind of on their journey since maybe 03 and 07, they've kind of grown up, it seems, the whole of New Zealand rugby. That image of the kind of dour, bullying Kiwi is no more. And it seems a very humble, a very grounded group as well.
It certainly is, Wes, and I think that comes across. Steve Hansen himself sort of reflected on the pressure and the spotlight of Ashan and Richie McCaw when he was a young New Zealand captain when they lost to France in that quarterfinal in 2007. I'm quite sure his world was devastated. I know Graham Henry's was. But I think the key issue in New Zealand, and it's something that maybe Ireland could learn from, you know, in their worst moment, when they lost to France in 2007, they stuck with their key people. They stuck with Richie McCaw as captain. They reappointed Graham Henry, and that came about because the players wanted him. And, you know, I thought that was a brave decision when the whole of New Zealand was going apoplectic because they had lost another World Cup quarter final in this instance to France, but they stuck with them, and I think that that experience has made New Zealand the team that they are now. I mean, they grew as a unit. Now it all nearly came apart in New Zealand 4 years ago, but the pressure there was, you had to be in New Zealand at that World Cup to really appreciate the pressure that the New Zealand squad were under. And then the well-documented injuries to key players, the fact that Richie McCaw played throughout the tournament and never trained because he'd a broken bone on his foot. Mm. But I think that win in 2011, it you know, the monkey was off their back. They won the second World Cup, and for me, they've been liberated since. The quality of rugby they've played has been even better. 3 defeats in 54 tests, now 2 draws as well to Australia. But that no team has ever come close to maintaining that level of champion status for 4 years, and now they start all over again.
It's incredible, really, that, you know, I suppose we've all read a lot of stuff and heard a lot of stuff at this point about how, you know, they focus massively on their mental approach after that loss in 07. Gilbert Anoka, their kind of mental guru, has been mentioned a lot in the media. And, I mean, I suppose for a team that's World Cups aside is generally year on year so successful, it's incredible that they had the ability to review themselves so rigorously, so honestly. And it's hard to see, you know, it's hard to maybe see some other unions having the kind of humility or the self-awareness to complete that process to the same degree.
Well, yeah, I think that's why they are the best, because they make all the marginal gains in all the key areas. I mean, you're focusing there on their mental approach, their mental toughness. I mean, how does a New Zealand rugby player doubt himself? I mean, they win 85 or 90% of the games they play in. You know, so you would feel that shouldn't be an issue. But obviously there was something lacking in that they just couldn't get over the line in key World Cups for a long period of time. So they addressed those issues. And, you know, the other thing is, when everybody else has been bulking up to a massive degree, New Zealand have made a conscious effort to have more slimline forwards, because they feel that it's better for their endurance and key that they're able to recover quicker after games. Now, when you look, I made a point in my own piece in the Irish Examiner, you know, this morning, that a Rugby World Cup has become an endurance test. To play 7 matches in 6 weeks, given the physicality of the game now, you need a massive squad, but you also need to be in sort of freak physical condition. And when you consider that New Zealand got to the Rugby World Cup final, I think Tony Woodcock was probably the only first-choice player that they lost. And the frightening thing is, if they had to play again next, I think they could, because I don't think they sustained any injury during the World Cup final. Whereas Australia, you know, I think they were on their last legs a bit as well. And, you know, as I mentioned, those injuries to Gitto and Kane Douglas had a huge impact on them. But it looked to me afterwards if they just hadn't an ounce of energy left.
But there's a lot made time and time again about the whole Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere divide. But that issue around the physicality and what you prioritise in a rugby player, is that one of the main lessons that we should be taking from this World Cup? Because, you know, Argentina, Australia, there's similar traits there increasingly.
Yeah, there is. But I think, look, you have to nearly go back to genetics. The Polynesian blood in New Zealand, certainly it gives them a very strong starting base. You have the fans base in South Africa, means that they will never be short of big men. Argentina are complete freaks in that if you go to the quarterfinal against the semi-final against Australia, 48 minutes into that game, 5 of their 8 forwards were under 23 years of age. They finished the game with 6 forwards under 23 years of age, and they're all massive physical specimens. You know, that just seems to be the, like, we generally were not as bulky on this, you know, our Irish players, and we spend massive amounts of time then in making them here, but that doesn't necessarily make them more skillful. I mean, you look, for me, Brodie Retallick, he's 6'8". Outside of being an outstanding set-piece player for New Zealand, look at the amount of times that he handles the ball and where he is almost a pivot player, where he makes the decision whether it's going to be carried up or whether it's going to be passed into the back line to continue the move. You know, we just don't... All their rugby players are completely comfortable without the ball. I mean, I remember 2 years ago saying that, you know, if there was no scrums and lineouts in rugby, New Zealand would win every game by 80 points. But even they've mastered their lineout has been phenomenal throughout the World Cup. And, you know, their scrum, while they're never dominant to the extent that a French or an Argentinian or a South African pack would want to be, they're never found wanting either. So, you know, they are really the team of all skills.
I remember Pat Lamb, I think you might have been on with us, Donal, on Against the Head the night Pat Lamb was in. But he was telling us that Tom McCartney, the hooker that Connacht brought from Auckland, was called the Freak in Auckland because of his gym scores. And then when he actually came to Connacht, he was maybe midway through the pecking order. That just the kind of work they do is prioritised completely differently. But I suppose, as you say, they have a certain natural physicality to build on, whereas we're possibly trying to play catch-up on that front all the time.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, they are. They were always a robust nation. But, I mean, that point that Pat Lamb made, I think, is actually very significant. Because you look at some of the New Zealand players, you know, when they're in their clothes, and they're not huge. I mean, in fact, their biggest men in many respects, you know, are the likes of Sonny Bill Williams, Ma'a Nanu, and Julian Savea, who are all in the back.
Yeah.
And they have that explosive power as well. So, you know, but it's just their skill set, I mean, and their appreciation of what needs to be done. I mean, the other thing is, you look, they don't put a huge number of men into the breakdown, but if there is any sniff of a chance of a turnover, all of a sudden 4 or 5 players come in and they flood the contact area. You know what I mean? They just hone into the fact that they may be in a position to generate a key turnover, and everybody then moves into an attacking position. They'll never kick that ball. They will always look to counter-attack.
Just, you mentioned you've been involved either as a manager, as a player, as a pundit and analyst in every Rugby World Cup. You know, we can debate the greatest team of all time, but this All Black squad, it's probably the greatest World Cup squad we've ever seen.
No question about that. I think, you know, I was lucky enough, I saw them 4 times in the World Cup, and... you know, from the, you know, I mentioned Sonny Bill Williams. He doesn't get into the starting team. You have Naholo on the wing, who was absolutely sensational throughout Super Rugby. He doesn't get onto their side. You know, right from the start, I saw their opening game against Argentina. It's just the range and of skills and their approach to the game. I mean, their defence is up there with the very best in the world. Mm. Their continuity play. And, you know, I thought it was interesting, you know, when you looked at Argentina, and you can call it naivety if you like, the manner in which they looked to run so much possession right from the start of their World Cup semi-final against Australia, and the intercept try from Rob Simmons after a minute. The coach said afterwards, you know, he wouldn't change a thing. They've taken, Graham Henry went in, as we know, and said, look, that the continuity play had to improve. They had to learn how to offload, which they took on board. But what I was surprised is, given the New Zealand influence on that Argentinian side, New Zealand kicked the ball more than anybody else. So therefore, it just goes to show that you have to marry the practical with the skill level, and that is where New Zealand excel. Plus the fact that they can just do it in all conditions, mm-hmm. and that was proved in the semi-final against South Africa, the only game where the rains came down from you know, certainly right throughout the second half. So that asked a different type of question of New Zealand. But once again, they were able to answer it.
And, you know, I know a lot of people read the James Kerr book, Legacy, about the All Blacks a couple of years ago, and you know, about cleaning the dressing rooms afterwards and players being judged on character as much as everything else. They are just a class act. Like, you know, the Sonny Bill Williams thing, we can talk about the medal. Dan Carter getting a bit of grief over taking the final conversion with his right foot, which apparently was akin to a childhood dream for him. Like, people are losing the run of themselves or they're getting stuck into him over that.
Absolute rubbish. I mean, show me an out half who, you know, show me a top out half who can't kick the ball with both feet.
Yeah, exactly.
The fact that he chose to kick a conversion with his right foot, given to the as opposed to his left foot, what are people getting excited about?
Yeah, it'd be different if it was McCaw or a prop or someone who'd gone up to take it.
Yeah, I mean, when the Namibian prop took some lad whose name escapes me, who was retiring, he took a conversion, you know, at the last minute of a game that they were being well beaten in, and people said, this is the spirit of rugby.
It's rubbish.
You know what I mean?
Is he the best out half of all time, Donald, in your opinion?
I think he is. And I think what's incredible is that he came into this tournament with sort of his own, we're beginning to doubt him. Now, when I say his own, I'm talking about the New Zealand public, because he didn't have a good Super 15 year. He struggled with injuries for the past 2 years.
He couldn't displace Colin Slade in the Crusaders team at one point this season.
Well, when he came back, he was playing in the centre for the vast majority of the Crusaders game. His place kicking even started to let him down at times. But again, it's just the belief that he has in himself. And the biggest test of a player is on the highest stage, in the most pressurised environment, when you produce it there. And that's exactly what he did. Even in the pool stages, I thought, again, referring back to that opening game against Argentina, I didn't think he was outstanding that day. And Beauden Barrett comes on and, you know, he is an unbelievable player. I mean, he has the pace of a winger. He has the skills of an outside centre. And he has a kicking game to match. And I thought that Carter might come under pressure from Barrett on the evidence of the opening game. But obviously Steve Hansen knows him. He's worked with him for a long period of time. And, you know, when they got into the real, I mean, there was an element with New Zealand this time. They didn't actually play, or they made more mistakes in some of the pool games against some of the lesser sides between them before. Butchered try-scoring opportunities, dropped passes, but it was almost as if they knew that in times past they had played unbeatable rugby in the pool stages and were found wanting in the knockout phase. This time round, they got everything absolutely spot on.
Just a word on Australia. How satisfied should... OK, there'll be disappointment for losing the final, but overall, how satisfied should Cheka be with not just Rugby World Cup, but managing to take them to a Rugby World Cup final a year and a week into the job?
Well, I think in many respects, Damien, that's probably the story of the World Cup. I mean, he was in the job, I think, 1 year and 9 days on the day of the final.
Yeah.
They were in disarray when he took over. And even incredibly, he still did his job at the Waratahs in Super 15. He ran two jobs parallel to each other. Now, people said that couldn't be done. Now, I don't think it can be done for a sustained period. But, you know, Cheka has shown he has this capacity to go into sides, quality, you know, sides, but who aren't performing or who aren't gelling together, and he gets the culture right. He's done it time and again. I also think he was in a fantastic position because Ewan McKenzie stepped down from his role, I think, 9 days before they were due to come on their tour to Britain and Ireland last year. They wanted Cheka, but Cheka was in the position to say, OK, I'll take the job, but I'll take it on my terms. One of those which, as I say, where I want to continue with the Waratahs for another season. He also knew that they, because the strength depth in Australia isn't as great as people think it is, and he knew he had to get people like Matt Gitto was the one guy that he wanted to get back into the fold. And I think the fact that he persuaded the Australian Rugby Union to do that just shows you how desperate they were to have him on board. But he changed the culture of the side again. I mean, this messing, I was there for the Lions tour in 2013 when you had James O'Connor, like how they ever thought of picking him at out half. I mean, when you look at it 2 years on, it was ridiculous in a Lions series. But when himself and Beale and, you know, this rubbish of eating burgers at 4 and 5 in the morning and the Tuesday before the second test, there wasn't a hint of that. There wasn't a sight of any disruption. And he wouldn't put up with it. And I think the senior players, certainly the Stephen Moores of this world, they were thrilled that an authoritarian figure came in at the perfect time. And it goes to show you don't really need 4 years to build to a World Cup. And certainly what Cheka has achieved is phenomenal.
I know you've talked about it on various programmes. You were quite taken with the show that Rugby World Cup was for, you know, the show that England put on. Your player of the tournament, if I can ask you to give me that.
Yeah, well, it was Pocock stood out for a mile in the early weeks and even up to the semi-final. Certainly Dan Carter, I think, narrowed that gap. But for me, Pocock, I just think he's a phenomenal athlete. Australia, again, struggled. When he wasn't there against Scotland, you know, they all but lost the game. But for a refereeing decision, they probably would have lost the game. He didn't feature against Ireland when we beat them in Auckland 4 years ago in the World Cup. And that is the measure of the guy. I mean, he is an unbelievable rugby player. And his influence, he was injured for sort of long periods over the last few years. And you can see Australia with him and without him are two completely different sides. So for me, I just think he's an outstanding player.
OK, your moment of the World Cup.
Well, I suppose there were several. Definitely, look, the South African Japan game in the opening weekend was just unbelievable. We were in the media room. I think Ireland had just played Canada, and you're kind of looking up and you're saying, yeah, you know, Japan, they're giving them a good game here, but they never win those tier two sides. They never come out on top in those games. But to win in the manner that they did, not taking the penalty at the end, everybody was, what are you doing? And you know, to get the reward, to do it like in a game to score a driving maul against South Africa, to drive them off scrums. I think it just highlighted what a quality coach Eddie Jones is, but also Steve Borthwick, who, you know, was captain of England under Martin Johnson, took a lot of stick, but was seen as a sort of a key tactical figure. And he was played that role as a captain both with Bath and with Saracens throughout his career. I think this guy has shown, you know, he is an outstanding, probably one of the best young coaches in the world, and he's coming back. I think he's gone to Bristol at the moment. But I think the moment off the field when all the day after that South African match, when at New Zealand and Argentina, when there was some Japanese supporters in their jerseys, when everybody just stood back and clapped them, you know, it just showed the respect. Everybody just recognised what Japan had done for the tournament. That was a special moment. I think the Sonny Bill thing at the end, taking off his medal. I mean, how could you script that? And now, you know, we've heard since that Rugby World have presented him with an additional medal. But
he's really making everyone, every other man on the planet, look bad. That guy at this point, isn't he?
Well, that's incredible. Well, as I said earlier, Wes, how do you not pick him? I mean, he was on the field. Conrad Smith is, you know, is the brains of the New Zealand backline. yet Steve Hansen, half-time, quite happy to make the change. And that was a change. That was a tactical change. Within 90 seconds, he has two of the most audacious offloads that you're going to see. And Nono scores under the post. He's, I mean, the guy...
He's unavailable next year as well. He's going to. He's concentrating on sevens for the year himself. Liam Messam and Ardy Savea are playing with the hoping to play in the Olympics.
So yeah, I know where I'll be putting my 50 pence for the Olympics. So
yeah, but doesn't it show already? Like here we are, as we know here in Ireland, we've had a sort of a strained relationship with sevens rugby. But everybody else now, to be fair to David Nusafora, as we know. He is massively interested in getting a sevens program put together because of the skills and all the other advantages that it can add to young developing players. But New Zealand, as you say, taking the likes of Messam and Sonny Bill William out of Super Rugby for a year to prepare for the Olympics. And don't put it beyond New Zealand then, with the Lions coming the following year, that they'll make sure Sonny Bill is back in Super Rugby to take part in that series.
I suppose, Donal, inevitably Ireland's going to come up at some point. I mean, you spoke there a minute ago about, you know, how New Zealand backed their people in 2007 and there was a lot of learning along the way. I mean, is there something in, you know, we've all praised Joe Schmidt, and rightly so, for his meticulousness and his attention to detail. Is a learning thing from this World Cup possibly an acknowledgement that in a tournament like this, you have to possibly delegate a little bit, that you, it's very, very hard to micromanage everything from your players to your staff to your to media dealings, etc. Is that maybe something we can take going forward?
Well, I think it is. Look, I mean, every coach, the best coaches of the world will tell you that they're constantly learning. Joe Schmidt has never been involved in a tournament like this before. I mean, before he went to Argentina with Ireland on tour in 2014, he'd never been on a rugby tour before. His whole rugby education was in club rugby. Now, when I say club rugby, I'm talking about provincial rugby in New Zealand. I'm talking about Clermont, who are obviously at the top of their trade in the top 14 in France, and of course what he did with Leinster. But tournament rugby is another animal altogether, and I have no doubt that Joe Schmidt will have learned a massive amount from it, and he will be a better coach as a result of that. For me, there is no way Ireland would have won the Six Nations Championships in the last 2 years without him. He is an integral part of this Irish setup, and you know, he is already, there was a suggestion, you know, we saw England poking around, just testing the waters a couple of weeks ago. He's committed to Ireland for the next 2 years, and hopefully to the next World Cup. But I think he will certainly be a better coach, and all his management will be better. Simon Easterby is a young coach at that level. Unfortunately, we lose Les Kiss is going to Ulster, but they will all be better as a result of what they went through over the last 7 weeks.
From an Irish perspective, and maybe a player's perspective, who was the winner in Rugby World Cup 2015? Who's the player that came out that possibly we will see, you know, a new dimension within the Six Nations?
Yeah, I think two players stood out for me. Ian Henderson, right from the start, I thought, you know, even, you know, when I watched him at under 21 level with Ireland, you knew this guy was a special talent. But he has that physical endurance and physicality that, you know, we're talking about in the Argentine, the young Argentine forwards. But again, even Henderson, I think, was taken by surprise by the level of physicality of those Argentine forwards in the quarterfinal. But you must remember, he wasn't a fixture in the Ulster side even last season. He's come a long way. Paul O'Connell is now retired at this level. He's finished, so Henderson, I think, should now be a fixture in the second row with Ireland. And the other player for me was Robbie Henshaw. I thought he was outstanding in the World Cup. Again, in adversity against Argentina, he was just, his commitment was phenomenal. You could see that he was hurting, given the way that Ireland, you know, the game was going against him. But he never gave up. He was the same against France. I think he's brought a new physical edge to his game. I think, you know, his skill levels can improve, but he's 22 years of age. He's not playing in the centre that long. So, I mean, there are two players that I think, if we do manage to get a World Cup in 2023 back here in Ireland, those two could still be central to Ireland's cause in 8 years' time.
We all love to speculate when a World Cup ends, you know, about, oh, let's start putting the plan in place for 4 years' time and bringing in young fellas and all this, and it never happens, and we don't expect it to happen wholesale. But looking at the Six Nations this year, I mean, is there a place maybe, especially in light of injuries, for possibly CJ Stander to come on board maybe a little further down the line? When you look at four New Zealand-born 13s playing in the provinces, is there a place for Gary Ringrose maybe to be slowly brought into the setup? I mean, is there anyone you see breaking in, so to speak, in the next few months?
Well, I think those two, you've hit the nail on the head there, Wes. I haven't seen a whole lot of Munster this year, but I only went over to the final on the first flight out of Cork Saturday morning, so I was able to sit down and watch Munster and Ulster on Friday night in the Guinness Pro 12. It was a cracking game, but I thought Stander was sensational. Mm-hmm. And given that Peter Omani, I mean, his swelling is so bad, his knee hasn't gone down to the extent that they can do a scan to find out the exact extent of his injury. So that'll tell you the damage that he did to his knee.
This seems like a season-long thing then, does it?
I think so. I can't see that how he'd be back with for the Six Nations. So therefore, I think Stander brings something else. He's such a better rugby player now than he is when he came in. And to be fair to him, it has taken him time. He didn't cry. It took him a long time to get a starting position in the team. But like even, I think, 78 minutes against Ulster, Dan Tuohy had come on, almost scores in the corner. And the fella who broke his back to make the covering tackle in the last second was Stander. So I think he will come into the reckoning. I can't see how Joe Schmidt could afford to ignore him. No. I'd be amazed if he wasn't brought into the squad for their Christmas, their first preparatory period. And again, Ringrose, look, I've been a fan of his since I watched him at under 20 level. I've seen him play for UCD in the All-Ireland League. Leinster seemed to be sort of drip-feeding him into this game by playing him on the wing in a couple of matches. But even the ones that I saw, you can just see the raw pace and the talent is there. It's a question of when. But I think in Joe Schmidt, he probably has the best man and the right man in the right place to nurse his development over the next 12 months.
Final question. So having been there, having looked at Rugby World Cup 2015, having seen the size of some of the grounds that they managed to fill, when you start to look at what we have on offer for 2023, could World Rugby's head be significantly turned to look at, say, France, Italy, places that have massive football stadia that they could fill the way they did over the course of the last 6 weeks?
I think it is a potential problem. There's no doubt. Like, if France go for it, that could be an issue. But look, they had it in 2007. But the bottom line for me is, the rugby stadia that we will have, that we will potentially have, and the likes of Parky Cleeve and Casement Park, hopefully, come on stream, they will put us in a very, very strong position to host the World Cup. The doubt is, how do you replicate England banking on the fact that 90,000 people would turn up to watch Ireland play Romania in Wembley at outrageous prices? I mean, 150, 170 sterling, that, well over 200 euro. But that said, if the equivalent of that would be, say, England playing Romania in Croke Park, marketed properly, flights in and out of England, it shouldn't be an issue. But I also think that Rugby World, they shouldn't get besotted with just the money itself. I think the reason they needed England to be a success financially was, New Zealand 2011 was never going to generate the type of money that World Rugby need to keep the game evolving and to help the Tier 2 and Tier 3 nations. And I think, Damon, there's a point that we should make here. The Tier 2 nations were outstanding in the World Cup. But one of the reasons for that was the support that World Rugby put into them in terms of finance and coaching expertise in the 2 years building up to the World Cup. So therefore, they are spending the money in the right places. But I think they'll make so much money out of this England one that every now and then, they shouldn't make money the top priority. And for me, Ireland ticks all the boxes in terms of hosting what would be a magnificent World Cup.
Okay. Donald, appreciate your time and your thoughts on Rugby World Cup 2015. Good to talk to you as always.
Cheers. Thanks, Damien. Thanks, Wes.
See you, Donald.
That's Donald Lenihan with us. So we've come to the end of our Rugby World Cup 2015 podcast odyssey. We didn't get a chance to really talk about negatives or things that we would have looked back upon. Is the Craig Joubert incident, the way that was handled by World Rugby, is that really the only down point in Rugby World Cup 2015, the only area that you could say could have done better?
Certainly leaves a bad taste. I've tried not to get too worked up about this in the past, but there's been a lot of talk that the emphasis, certainly amongst the semi-finalists, bar South Africa, has gone back towards kind of identifying space and skill-based stuff rather than just, you know, running into people. But the attrition of the game, to me, is, I've had two people who wouldn't be from a rugby background just by the by say it to me in the last week that, I mean, it's really becoming a game a lot of people would actively tell their children not to play at this point.
I had the very same conversation with a colleague over the weekend whose son is rugby mad, and I think the Felix Jones thing was possibly the straw that broke the camel's back.
Well, to me, I'm not a sports scientist or anything, but I mean, bar possibly New Zealand, I didn't even think teams were capable of playing to their optimum 2 weeks in a row. Mm. I thought if you'd won a huge performance, invariably they dipped the following week and maybe recovered again. And then for the first time ever in games, even teams that were winning, were looking just out on their feet after 50, 60 minutes. Elite rugby at this stage, it's getting to the point you're a genetic freak to play it, and that's all that can play it.
But if you look at it from like a world rugby or an administrator's point of view, it's virtually impossible to change that now.
It is, and a lot of the measures you hear mentioned are actually counterintuitive in that, like, I've heard people talk about rolling subs.
Yeah,
as a way to kind of keep freshness or whatever, but like keeping introducing fresh players is just going to keep up in the collisions, not the opposite. So, I mean, I don't know. There's nothing you can really do. Guys are going to train. Guys are going to get bigger. It's very hard to take that out of it.
In terms of a player of the tournament, a moment of the tournament, anything like that, anything you want to add to what Donald said?
Pocock for me as well, unbelievable player. Like, I mean, he was brilliant in the last World Cup up to the semi-final. He was gave a masterclass in the quarter-final against South Africa in 2011, up against Heinrich Brousseau. McCaw kind of stole his thunder a bit in the semi-final, did his typical, came in on one foot and one man of the match and all that. And then since then, he's been interrupted with injuries, but he's a phenomenal player. 120 kilos as well. Like, he's a big, big man that people don't realise sometimes. Tough. I suppose the one thing that stood out maybe from the final was, it's a bit twee to say it, but the similarities I often see with New Zealand in any team in any sport is in Kilkenny, I often see it. Mm. Like, I mean, people say, how'd you negate Hooper and Pocock at the breakdown? And they negated him by running at him and tying him up and having him tied up on the floor. Like when you hear about Kilkenny going after the opposition's strongest player, you know? It just shows, I suppose, there's excellent teams have certain shared traits across all the sports, you know.
But it was a great tournament.
Brilliant tournament, yeah.
Now, I don't know, is it that you enjoy it more because it's in real time, whereas, you know, beyond the Ireland games and maybe Warburton being sent off 4 years ago, like, what really stands out for you from 4 years ago? Because it was all happening in the middle of the night, but for this one, you know, we will talk for years probably
about it. Yeah, the closeness definitely if it helps. And the only thing about it that's a little, I suppose, as it gets towards the end of a tournament, you want more and more games rather than, you know, when there is only a game a week or, you know, two games at the weekend and then a gap for a week compared to, say, a soccer World Cup or a European Championship. Mm. Obviously, we know the recovery time, etc. Yeah. It can't be done. But as a supporter, I think, you know, maybe the scheduling of the games, even in the pool stages, there was days at the start where they'd play four games on a Saturday and then there'd be none for 4 days. You know, maybe there's a way to kind of spread it out a little better, possibly. And it's long as well, 7-8 weeks of a tournament. It's very long.
We never brought this up with Donal. What did you make of Nigel Owen's performance in the final? Certainly, most people seem to think New Zealand should have been reduced to 14 men.
Yeah, I've never quite been in the Nigel massive fan club that everyone seems to be.
But it's Nigel the character as much as Nigel the referee.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know people love to, especially people not involved in rugby, love to talk about the respect for the referee as being a great part of the game. I actually think sometimes it goes a little too much the other way, and referees can talk down to players quite a bit, which is ridiculous at this day and age. But, you know, a lot of people talk about Nigel's feel for the game and his interpretation and the spirit of the game. And look, if the players like him, that's the main thing, and they do seem to. But sometimes I kind of think a rule's a rule. You know, it's not up to you to interpret the rule, it's up to you to enforce
it. And it's the same for both teams, not necessarily.
Well, I mean, that pass to New Zealand in the first half, early when they went down the wing, just before Milner Scudder's try, blatant forward pass in the build-up. You know, now it's like, well, his hands weren't going forward. You're like, well, look, the ball either went forward or it didn't.
Yeah.
You know, there's no room for interpretation there.
I sense we could be still here in 4 years' time debating the same things.
Yeah,
debating
look, he's an excellent ref. That's nitpicking, you know what
sending
I mean?
Sending off or not a sending off?
For which incident?
The Smith, wasn't it? The tip tackle.
Oh, not a chance. Jeez, I thought he was harsh to even get a yellow. Michael Hooper was driving him down as much as Smith was.
Grant, okay.
Not a chance for me anyway, no.
Okay, right. We'll leave it there. Thank you for your company over the last couple of weeks. We've had a phenomenal amount of people listening. So you've obviously the people of Ireland who like rugby like listening to fellas sit in confined rooms spoofing away. So
yeah, spoofing in the operative
there we
word.
Go. Anyway, Wes, to you and to Gary who was here and to all the different pundits and guests who joined us over the course of the couple of weeks. Thank you for your time. We don't know when we'll speak again, but until then, good luck.